Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Gemini GEL, Graphic Editions Limited, the renowned Los Angeles artist workshop and publisher of fine art limited edition prints and sculptures, has collaborated with some of the most influential artists of the last half century, including Klaus Oldenburg, Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, V.I. Selmans, Ellsworth Kelly, Anne Hamilton, Julie Marateau, Bruce Nauman, Richard Serra, and many more. On October 1st, 2015, in advance of the opening of the exhibition The Serial Impulse at Gemini GEL at the National Gallery of Art, Gemini GEL co-founder and co-director Sidney B. Felsen joins Lauren Shell Dickens to discuss the genesis and growth of the workshop since its establishment in 1966. Felsen also shares behind-the-scenes stories about artists and their projects and considers the future of contemporary printmaking. The conversation is guided by Felsen's own photographs of artists at work. The Serial Impulse at Gemini GEL is on view from October 4th, 2015 to February 7th, 2016.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. It is indeed a pleasure to sit across from Sidney on this stage. And as Judith just attested, the history of Gemini, founded in 1966, is robust and a little overwhelming. You have produced over 2,500. Is that the right number? 2,300. 2,300. Prints and sculptural editions over the past 50 years. You've worked with, the roster of artists who you've worked with reads like a contemporary art history book. It's a who's who of the art world. In addition to the artists we have in the exhibition, Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, Oldenburg, Frank Stella, there are a whole host of other artists who we didn't include in the exhibition who are, you know, equally renowned. Bryce Martin, Mark DeSouvreau, Anne Hamilton, Philip Guston, I mean, the list goes on and on. And it seemed appropriate here on the occasion of the exhibition and the 50th anniversary to look back at the past some and hear it from you, Sidney, who were there every day over the past 50 years. So the obvious place to begin, 1966. Okay. Why did you decide to found a printmaking workshop and publisher?
Well, let's see. First of all, I you know, went through all the way through schools, meaning public school, high school, and college, with zero interest in art. And in those days, there was always a choice between art or music as an elective, and I always took music. And I think I was somewhat concerned about, I thought art was sort of magic and I didn't know how to do it, and so I stayed away from it. And then after college, I had a girlfriend who I liked, and I'd go to her house or to pick her up, and I saw these things on the wall and I thought they were terrible and they were all very abstract, and I liked her family, and it made me inquisitive of why do these people like these things. And so I started reading about art, and then I decided I'd go to art galleries, and then I got interested in art, and decided I wanted to paint, so I took painting lessons, and then I started going to art schools, and I did that for, you know, 20 years or so at nighttime and weekends after I graduated college. And so a couple of things happened, and I as I went on in my education of art, I became more interested in ceramics, and so that became what I did, really, wheel throwing and porcelains. But I had, I was a CPA, and I had a practice, and I had a client who was an art gallery, and he was importing prints from Europe, you know, the usual Picasso, Chagall, Miro, Clavé, Marino, Marini, and all that. And so I sort of got interested, I was paying attention to that, and I found out that they were coming from workshops in Europe, and that there was such a thing. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, somewhere there was a man named Joseph Sulwick who was from Europe, and he was like an individual who would bring prints into the United States, and he'd go to your house or somebody's house and, you know, have like a, you know, some sort of a session where he'd show his prints and the ideas, the public would buy them. So it sort of roused my curiosity, and then I just seemed to pay more and more attention to prints as I was being exposed to them at the gallery. And in college days, I had what became my best friend was Stanley Grinstein, and Stanley and his wife Elise were collecting contemporary art at a very early stage, and quality contemporary art. And so Stanley and I stayed buddies or friends, and he would come to class with me and keep me company. Well, he didn't want to make art, but just keep me company. And so one day I just said to Stanley, you know, they have these workshops in Europe, and it'd be fun to have one here, and we'd get to know the artist, and we'd build a collection for ourselves. And so he said something about, you know, I don't know anything about it, but if you want to do it, I'll do it with you. And so neither of us knew anything about it. Well, you need a printer to start a print shop. And so Kenneth Tyler had started a shop in Los Angeles called Gemini Limited, and it was a for-hire shop where you know, you're an artist, you bring me prints, and I print them for you, and mm-hmm. for a fee, I return them to you. And he had done that for about a year, and he was a high-quality printer. This was 1964, 65. There was no art market. I think if you were an artist, you probably had to teach to make a living in almost all cases. And, you know, if you saw the prices of what the abstract expressionist paintings were in those days, you wouldn't believe it. And so so we went to, and so Tyler had functioned for about a year, and apparently wasn't able to go on much longer financially. And so he was talking to UCLA about taking over the shop as a teaching institution, and they talked and talked, and nothing happened. So on Christmas Eve of 1965, we invited Ken Tyler to come to the Grinstein house for their Christmas party, and we sat with him and proposed that we change Gemini into a publishing house, you know, which means you invite the artist, you own the art, you sell the art to the world, and generally the way you pay an artist is through a royalty. And so Tyler said yes. I think realistically we were probably the only game in town for him, but we marched towards starting Gemini. And so we spent the next month every night in my office with a list of names of artists, you know. and we started out thinking we'd work with local artists and so on, and then we sort of got turned on to the idea, why not pursue the more accomplished artist, and so that's how we started. So.
Speaking of accomplished artists, you're sure.
Is that that's a long answer to a simple question.
It's not a simple story.
Okay. Again, we approached the abstract expressionists, you know, Rothko, Hans Hofmann, de Kooning, Magritte, who wasn't an abstract expressionist. Many of them, and realistically, nobody. They really weren't printmakers by attitude. So, but this is an image of it's called a white line square, and it's by Joseph Albers. And Ken Tyler had worked at Tamarind, and he was the technical director there, and he worked with Joseph Albers. And so he called Albers and asked him if he would consider working with us as doing the first project, and he said yes, he would. So that was it. So Albers lived in Orange, Connecticut. I think he was teaching at Yale. And so he wouldn't travel, but he would, you know, his images are so simple as far as printmaking. So what he would do is he would take a cardboard from a shirt and paint it in a square, and he'd tear it in half, and he'd give us half, and we'd keep half, and so we were just matching out what he had done, and so that was our first project.
So you started with this idea of working with very established artists. You start with Albers, and then you did a few additions with Man Ray,
Yeah. Well, Man Ray, you know, it was an anomaly, really, but the Los Angeles County Museum had a Man Ray retrospective in 1966, and I think Stanley was the president of the Contemporary Art Council, and somewhere the museum asked him whether Man Ray could stay at his house, and so, which he did. And so Man Ray started hanging around the shop, and we were embarrassed to ask him, but he asked us. He said, "You want me to do something?" So that was that project. So, but then what happened was, you know, Bob Rauschenberg used to come to Los Angeles somewhat regularly, and he was ice skating in Culver City, and he was involved in certain things in Los Angeles, and so. We talked to him, would he come and work with us, and he said yes. And so in early February of 1967, he was scheduled, he did his first project mm-hmm. with us. I picked him up at LAX and I asked him did he have any idea what he wanted to do, and he said, "Well, I'm thinking about doing a self-portrait of inner man," which I had no idea what that meant, and I didn't ask him any further. So I dropped him off at his hotel, and I picked him up in the morning, and he said, "Do you know anybody who's an X-ray doctor?" And it just so happened I'd gone to high school and college with someone who was a practicing X-ray doctor, and so I took him to Jack Waltman was his name, and so what Bob wanted was an X-ray of his body, head to toe, one plate. And we found out there is no such thing other than in Rochester, New York, at Eastman Kodak, they have a machine like that. But otherwise, all X-ray machines are 1 foot. And so he didn't want to go back to Rochester. And so we had 6 plates made, and boosters, what you're looking at, is what came out of that. And so, again, this print was 6 feet vertical and 3 feet horizontal. And we're talking about 1966, 67, prints were 30 by 22. That was a standard print. That's what you thought of printmaking. And, you know, and so the belief is that this was the largest print ever made, largest hand-printed lithograph ever made at that time. And we didn't have a stone that big. And so it's really, there's 2 stones that are joined. Some of you probably can't see the joining, but it was like 3 feet and 3 feet. And Booster became a phenomenal success, really. It became an icon of the print period that started in the middle 60s. So.
Right out of the gate, you made an icon. Yeah.
A year later, he did a project called Stone Moon, based upon the launching of Apollo 11. Bob was a guy who'd come in the studio maybe at 11 o'clock in the morning and probably work until 11 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night. But in this particular morning, he had worked 24 hours. He went all the way around the clock, never stopped. And our printers would go on rotation as far as 2 of them would go sleep for a few hours. And so he came out at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that bike was in the parking lot. And so he just was having a little bit of fresh air. So.
And in addition to arriving at your doorstep, creating icons like Booster, he also is fairly responsible for the early development of your artist programs.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. This is a picture of Frank Stella with Ken Tyler. And Frank Stella had accepted a teaching gig at UC Irvine. And he was at that time he was married to Barbara Rose, who is an art critic, and they came to Irvine. When they went to the campus, they found out that you have to sign a loyalty oath to, I think it was the United States government or California, I don't know which, and Barbara signed it and Frank wouldn't, and so he had nothing to do, and so he started hanging around the shop when Bob was there. And again, I think Frank was 29 years old at this time. And so he hang around day after day after day. And Bob Rauschenberg always liked to have a lot of people hanging around when he was working. He would put the TV on, watch soaps, talk to you, and while he's making his art and so on. And so I don't know, there was this one moment where there was a bunch of limestones that were 17 by 23 inches and they were very thin, so that you could pick it up. So he picked up a stone and handed it to Frank and said, "Why don't you go back in the corner and draw?" And So those black, when you go through the exhibition, if you haven't seen it already, what's called Black Series, and that's what happened. That's what came out of that moment where Bob gave him the stone. And then after that, we were talking on the telephone to Klaus Oldenburg, and Bob grabbed the phone and said, "You got to come out here. You know, it's really great. The greater the sunshine and the palm trees and stuff." So Oldenburg showed up, and then shortly after that, I wrote a letter to Jasper Johns, asking him to come to Germany, and he did. So it was all in all this was in a period of 2 or 3 years. So.
Right. And can you talk a little bit about, so you're in Los Angeles in the 60s. You mentioned that there was no art world.
About the art scene in Los Angeles?
Yeah, there's no art world at that point. How did you advertise what you were doing?
Well, look, Los Angeles had an interesting scene going on as far as great artists, mm-hmm. but they weren't nationally known. There was, every region, I think, has good artists, but, between... John L. Toon and Ken Price and Billy L. Bankston and Robert Irwin and I'm going to forget some of them, I shouldn't, but there was a lot of good artists, and there was a gallery called the Ferris Gallery that Irving Blum ran, and there was a gallery that Nicholas Wilder ran, it was a scene that was a little bit successful within its own mm-hmm. village, you might say.
Ferris had just closed at this point, hadn't it?
Well, Ferris closed in 1973.
Oh, okay.
So it was really the one that showed most of the names that I mentioned. But Nicholas Wilder showed Bruce Nauman and Ron Davis and I think David Hockney, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. amongst others. But it was, New York scene, what happened was, I still say there was no art market as such, but coincidentally, by when we started, right around 66 or 67, called the New York art scene, that was, all of a sudden, it started to become alive and accepted and collected, and Look magazine or Life magazine would have these articles of these silly things of Andy Warhol doing this or that or some guy painting a flag it was new art
but when you had Art Forum in LA at that moment,
oh,
didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. Well, Art Forum was started in San Francisco and then moved to Los Angeles, and their office was on La Cienega, and that Joseph Albers White Line Square series, in fact, the yellow one that you projected, I carried the... We decided to put our first ad in Art Forum in June of 1966, and so I carried the copy over to this to the office, and there was this kid that took it and started to lay out the work, and that kid was Ed Ruscha. And Wallace Berman was also influential in the Los Angeles market. But it never had the acceptance or the acclaim that the New York art scene had in those early days.
So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you were founded as a lithography, a printmaking shop.
Started, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Very quickly, you started doing.
Yeah.
Much more ambitious.
We did lithography only. And then in 1968, when Klaus Oldenburg came out, he said, do you want to do a sculpture multiple? And we said yes. We had no idea what it really meant. But
yes.
So what you're looking at is work on paper of a drawing, a line drawing of, this is a Chrysler Airflow, for those of you that weren't around. This was a very aerodynamic car back in those days. And so it has the base of a line drawing of that car. And then what Klaus wanted was a sculptural cover to go fit on top of it that would be, obviously transparent. Use the word elastomeric, which means you could bend it, twist it, and he wanted the color to be jujube green or swimming pool green, either one. So we had to find a mold maker, and we asked and we asked and we asked, and we tried some mold makers, and they really were not able to do it. But then somebody told us that the chief mold maker at Disney Studio was really really, you know, a super mold maker. So we went to him, and he made the mold that worked. And so, you know, this has got a long story to it.
That's
but,
it.
You know, but so we made an addition of 75, and I think we sold almost every one of them. And they were out for about a year, and then somebody called and said, you know, my car is turning yellow and brown. And then, yeah, and so somebody else called and said, my airflow is getting brown. So we went back and we had some, you know, exhibition copies and so on, and they were starting to turn brown. Hmm. So we found out that there was something wrong with the chemical formula that was used, and so we hired a chemist and blah, blah, blah. And so there was a material called aliphatic isocyanate that was not in the formula that was sold to us by this manufacturer. So we, you know, like Detroit, we called all the cars back. And then we remade them, and we sent them out, and it's now 40 some years later, and so they haven't returned. So, yeah. But they're beautiful. So it really, you know, it got us into the idea of sculpture was a possibility. We I think up until that time we really hadn't thought about it. So, mm-hmm. Well, this is a picture of the giant ice bag. And in 1969, Los Angeles County Museum had a major exhibition. It was about art and technology. What they did was they selected certain artists and then went to certain people in industry and asked them if they would partner with an artist about making something the artist wanted to do. And so somewhere they tied Klaus Oldenburg into Disney Studios. Disney agreed, and then Klaus went there and explained to him what he wanted to do. And it was a giant ice bag that would rise to 18 feet. And so the Disney people picked it up as an artist was using it as a symbol of America having a giant headache. And so they wouldn't do it. And so Klaus came back to us, and we were talking about things. And so we decided maybe we would find somebody to build it. So there was a company in Hollywood called Croft, K-R-O-F-F-T, Sid and Marty Croft, and they were building props for TV and motion picture studios. So they you know, they agreed to do it for a fee, so we hired them, and they built this thing, and it was a great success. So.
And you just said yes. Anything the artist wants to do, you try and do it. You're a small shop at this point.
Well, we had an attitude. We'd say yes, you know, if something was we couldn't handle financially, we probably would have had to say no. The impossible will take a little while. So that was the attitude. So, yeah. So.
I just want to go back. So in 1971. I believe, was the retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, the Art and Technics.
71, yeah.
71. So yeah. You're...
5 years old.
5 years old, and you're having a retrospective.
Yeah.
Was that a surprise?
It probably was a shock. Well, William Lieberman was the head of probably the print and drawing department out at the Modern, and he really called the three of us, Stanley and Ken and me, and said, we're interested in doing an exhibition of what you've done at Gemini. So, wow. So we said yes, and you know, it was great for us. Yeah, yeah.
So you've gone from thinking that it's fun to work with, it'd be great to work with some artists and produce some prints for our own collection, to here's a retrospective of the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah, I still think in the very beginning you don't realize, you know, these artists were still fairly young, mm-hmm. and the art scene wasn't, you know, if you want to talk about an art scene being developed, I mean, now it's like this, and it was still fairly small, so you didn't realize how much of a part of art history would become, or how important these artists really were, or, you know, certainly by the idea of the Museum of Modern Art wanting to do it, it was one of those moments where, it's one of those incidents that starts to register what's really happening. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Did it change the way you were thinking about what you were doing? The way you were selecting artists, or?
I don't think so. No, the interesting part, it's all about art, but you still have to somewhat live in the world of economy. And 1971 and 72 and 73, if I remember right, were very bad years for the economy. So where in the very beginning we had it very easy, it was like you couldn't go wrong with these these projects we were doing, we were starting to struggle financially in that time, and so it was sort of was the tied into the modern show, and so it probably tempered it somewhat, but
One of your strategies, you know, working with artists, they all have very different personalities, different ways of working, and one of the strategies that you have at Gemini is a one artist at a time policy, right?
Yeah.
So each artist comes in, and you, in some ways, Gemini transforms around the shop to be the kind of environment that they can be creative in. I want to talk about, this is the beginning of the Hoarfrost project with Rauschenberg.
Yeah, okay.
So you talked a little bit about how he transformed the shop when he came in.
Yeah.
It was collaborative in nature. Can you talk about that a little more?
I'll comment on something else you said. You said something about one artist at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned that because there was a couple of incidents where we had two artists at the same time, and it's impossible. It's psychologically very bad for them because, you know, these are very accomplished people, and they need your attention. And if there's two artists, all of a sudden it gets divided, and even two artists that appreciated each other, it mm-hmm. doesn't work. It doesn't work. I'll do anything I can to keep ever and two artists being there again. It's uncomfortable for everybody.
We of course have to ask. You say you don't want to do it again. What happened? Who was it?
So Bob. Let's see. Well, look, Bob Rauschenberg was he was a heroic figure, and he was just very, he really had an attitude of you never say no, mm-hmm. and then I can do anything is possible. And he was so able to make the printers feel part of his project. And they, you know, Bob would leave and you could see tears rolling out of the eyes of some of the printers. He was such a great collaborator in that sense. And genuinely so. He wasn't, it wasn't a Mickey Mouse thing. It was really, that's the way he was. And just everything about him was just, heroic, and so to speak. And so, this is a picture of, the Hoarfrost, right?
The Hoarfrost, yeah. So they're selecting
so
the images.
1974. Some artists would champion the idea of a different imagery or a different approach to what they were doing. Bob experimented with, first of all, paper, and then handmade paper, going to paper mills, and then working with cardboard. And then this was fabric. And then, later on he worked on metal, and he worked on plastic, mm-hmm. and he'd always had to try everything, whatever was out there. And so this was a series where he, this was all on fabrics, and they were all kinds of fabrics, very high quality fabrics and very cheap fabrics. And it was 100 issues of the Los Angeles Times, and then he, a lot of the thing you see, he'd crumble up paper, put it on a press, and every one had a different page from a different paper, and then you'd run it through the press, and the press would flatten it down, and it flattened it down differently, so everyone was different.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably, of all the 50 years of all the projects we did, that one probably was the most dynamic as far as just encompassing the shop and, a certain amount of madness about it. But.
That's what is remarkable about these images is the number of people involved
in
the project. And that he comes in and he's really experimenting. He doesn't know. He's experimenting on your dime. Doesn't know what he's doing.
Some artists would come to Gemini with drawings of what they wanted to do, or paintings that they wanted to, again, these artists were very, very accomplished, and they didn't want to make a print that was just like their painting, or a painting just like their print. But, like Jasper Johns is a good example. He'd bring a picture of a painting, and he'd use it as a base, you might say, for imagery. But the print looked a lot different than the painting did. But Roy Lichtenstein would make little sketches or what he wanted to do, and he'd come to Gemini and he'd put it in an opaque projector, and then he'd blow it up to find out the scale he wanted it to be and things like that. But Bob, I think, always came to Gemini with nothing as far as attitude. He would rather sort of breathe the air of the moment and t- talk to 10 people and get some ideas of, that came into his head, and then he would start to do something. So, yeah.
And another artist who spent a considerable amount of time, Gemini, David Hockney.
Well, this is probably 1973, and David Hockney, mm-hmm. he was the only one that came to work wearing a suit and tie, and he was an English gentleman. He came to Los Angeles, I think, in probably the late 60s, and he was teaching at UCLA. And he came in the studio and he said, this is 1973, he said, Los Angeles is a great, great city, but it has no weather. And so he decided to draw the weather series. And so he drew, you know, snow and rain and sunshine and mist and lightning and things. That's what's going on here. So.
And then he also then went on to do a parade of portraits at Gemini.
Yeah, it was called Friends. And he invited, I think, 21 or 22 guys in to pose for him. And they sat, each one sat for 3 days. These are, there's Henry Geltzalter and Michael Crichton and Nicholas Wilder. And I don't know. Everybody was somebody. and what you have there is he had already drawn the portraits of these people. And then when it was all over, he decided he was going to make one print with all of them in a row, and so that's where he was lining them up. And by the time he got into it, he didn't like it, so he didn't do that. But he did draw the 22 thing. And I think I told you the one story about Billy Wilder, the film director, was one of the models, and so you know in hand printing, whatever you draw on a stone, it prints backwards. Like, let's say if you have a business card being made, you have a offset, so it goes from here to here, and it bounces back. So if he would draw you looking this way, it ended up printing you were looking that way. And so Billy Wilder looked at the picture, and he said he didn't like it. It was his bad side. Yeah. And so we had to, like, over-ink the stone and put another stone and get a printing off of it and transfer that, so we got back to the side he liked. Well, this was there was a fairly long era at Gemini where at break time we played basketball, and so that picture on the right side is Richard Serra and Frank Stella. They're both jumping up, and then the other people are Gemini printers. And so that went on for a few years, every 10 o'clock in the morning or 3 in the afternoon. And if Richard Serra was playing, the chances are somebody ended up with broken ribs. he was more than aggressive.
I think this image is great, though, too, because it shows just the camaraderie between the artists and the printers.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, I'd say Richard, Frank, Bruce Nauman, and Jim Terrell. They were the athletes. That Jim played basketball for college, and I think Bruce played at least in high school. So, yeah. Oh, this is Via Selmans, who's one of the illustrious members of the audience right now, and Via is one of the hardest working as far as, you know, her effort she puts into drawing, and Via is capable of drawing an inch across that for and take 3 or 4 hours. And then she'd move up another inch or so, and so I was always, you know, sort of spellbound by watching somebody with such great detail. And Via would regularly say, "I have to learn how to make art simpler." And by the time she did that, she learned how to make it more difficult. So, anyway, but she is great.
Well, and speaking of, you said you love watching Via work on this. Many of these are your photographs.
Yeah.
And I'm interested how you got started taking photographs of the artist. Mm-hmm. Kind of how you, well, this is such a sensitive moment when an artist is creating.
Well,
And I'm just going to click through some, so you don't have to talk about every single one, although you're welcome
to. All right. Well, for me, many benefits or rewards came from being, you know, at Gemini every day for 50 years. But for me, probably the one that stands out the most is the friendship with the artist. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it starts with being in the shop with them all the time, and then it becomes social, and it leads to travel. And so it also included, it brought about a privilege of being able to photograph them. And so, you know, it's one thing to have a hired gun where it's a photographer who comes in and would take your pictures. Mm-hmm. I think we had a legitimate friendships. And so, you know, I would ask him if it was okay to take pictures, and they almost always said yes. You know, that's where the pictures came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. And you just mentioned it led to travel. So beyond working, you know, with the artists at Gemini, you were also sort of responsible for introducing them to Los Angeles, showing them around. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Well, we try to do that, you know, showing this. Mm-hmm. Some artists are more inquisitive than others. But, you know, Bob Rauschenberg is another one that comes to mind. About him comes to mind is he wanted to see the city all the time. And so we would take him to Venice Beach. Or, you know, I would take him to all the places that I thought were interesting to me or comfortable to me. I've lived in Los Angeles my life, and there's places I won't go, and therefore I didn't take him. But the interesting part was later on he came and he wanted to do a series, and he said he was gonna call it L.A. Undercover, and he wanted to go everywhere. And so I called Joel Wax, who was a city councilman in Los Angeles, who was very art-oriented. And he told me to call the city hall, and there's an agency there where you can hire security guards that are ex-LA police officers. And so we hired two, and Bob and his companion spent every day of 2 weeks going everywhere in Los Angeles, everywhere. And he changed the name of the series from LA Undercover to LA Uncovered, and spectacular pictures of, you know, any neighborhood. So, yeah.
And this is a great one of De Souvre.
Well, this is Mark De Souvre. We were in Europe, and this is Amsterdam. You can see the Mercedes symbol in the lower left-hand corner. We were in that car, and he was leading us to his studio in Amsterdam where he was making sculpture.
And you would go and visit the artists in their studios on site, too, and you took a trip with Rauschenberg to India. I mean, this was... You were traveling everywhere with the artists.
Well, Rosamund and I went to India with Bob. Ken Tyler went to France with Bob, and Stanley and Elise went to China with Bob. But I would, you know, I would a lot of times go with artists going somewhere or go visit them somewhere. Yeah.
And working on projects as well, right?
Sometimes.
So
sometimes.
The trip to India with
India was a project. Yeah, all three of those were projects that I named. To China and the France.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, Bob he loved the idea of going to a paper mill, you know, a hand-making paper mill, and the paper became the art object, but he did something to it while it was being made. And so,
it's a great...
Well, great, I mean, this is... It's a sentimental picture. It's Jasper Johns on the left and Bob Rauschenberg on the right. And I say it's my Mount Rushmore picture. But I don't know. Anne may be in the studio, but this is Anne Hamilton. And, you know, she's fantastic to work with. And Anne was working on works on paper or fabric, or these are plastic. She was making ear trumpets. And so she was modeling for the product. There was a fellow who was, this was long before modern history or current history, but there was an Afghani from Afghanistan who was a friend, and he used to bring in rugs to, you know, he'd bring us the idea that we'd buy his rugs. And so, and then one day Bob was there and he brought in this robe. So Bob fell in love with the robe and he bought it. So.
And this is a picture in Sydney's office, so you can see your photographs.
My office, yeah.
That just kind of surround you with the history of what's happened in that place.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, Frank Gehry is a famous architect, but we all knew him before he became Frank Gehry. He was just a young architect. And so he used to hang around the shop a lot because Frank, one of his lines was, I like being with artists much more than I do being with architects. And so he formed many friendships in the early days with several of the artists. And so in 19, 76, so we were 10 years old, we needed more space. And so we asked him if he would design a building for us, and he did. And Elise Grinstein worked for him, and so she did some of the details of the building. And so in 1979, the building was finished, and Frank was just posing in front of that part of the building. So.
And you've done a number of printed editions with him, and a sculptural
when he draws, he scribbles, and then he puts that in the computer, it starts to read it, and so they're beautiful. And mm-hmm. so he draws onto very thin, almost translucent paper, some almost transparent, and so we were able to take those drawings or sketches and transfer them to printing mm-hmm. plates.
I'm curious how you do work with an artist who comes in, who you invite into the shop, who doesn't have a background in printmaking. Yeah. So how do you kind
you
of...
teach them. One of our printers went out to see him, and then he came in the studio, and you just show him how to draw, what works. You show him, you let him draw several different ways, and you show him how each one of those ways prints all on a piece of paper, and then he makes decisions of where he wants to go. So.
And when you're looking now, when you're looking for artists to invite, what kind of qualities, because you don't just invite printmakers, what kind of qualities are you looking for in your artist program?
We've had that discussion, and I use an expression. In sports, when they draft, a lot of teams would draft for someone who's an athlete, and certain teams would draft for somebody who's a running back or a wide receiver or a center or something like that. And my attitude more is the draft for the athlete. Look for somebody who you think they really. It's their ideas, their intelligence, their ability to draw has some importance to it, and then you can teach them printmaking. Mm-hmm. And so, in a lot of cases, Rauschenberg or Johns or David Hockney or Sam Francis, they were old pros by the time they got into our shop. But Frank Stella really had to be taught how to draw, and even Roy Lichtenstein later on, who he had always made dots and stripes and pasted them on and give them to a print shop and say, make a print. And one day he came to me and said, I really want to learn how to draw for printmaking. And so we gave him a printer for a week, and they went into a private room, and he spent a whole week learning how to draw, and he came out, and from then on he actually hand drew his prints. So,
yeah. Wow, you changed his working process.
Pardon?
You changed his working process. That's it.
Yeah. To some extent,
interesting.
Okay, well, this is Susan Rothenberg, mm-hmm. and Susan Rothenberg is about 5 feet tall, and she's using a crowbar to draw onto an etching plate, so that's an interesting picture, but she wanted to make deep grooves.
And so she's one of the artists who's in the exhibition and has worked at Gemini more recently.
Yeah.
How has your thinking changed about who you're inviting now? Who are the artists who you're kind of...
Well, recently, Julie Maritou, may be sitting here. Probably we met
picture of Maritou
10 years ago, and but it takes a while to work, sometimes to work out, working together. So mm-hmm. I'd say probably she started working with us 5 years ago. And right now, Anna Leah Saban is a young mm-hmm. artist mm-hmm. who's probably 32 or 33 years old, and she's proofing in the shop. Tacita Dean is also doing experimental proofing, so all of a sudden, all the ladies are coming in.
Yeah. I actually had the privilege of being there when Analia was, I think it was her second day in the shop, when I was talking to her, and she's not an experienced printmaker.
No, and she said something similar, the idea of could she come in and, could we, I don't know, whatever she said, can you teach us or can I practice or whatever, and so that's fine with us. So we encourage her to spend several days just, playing around with this or that idea or this or that instrument or something to draw with, and then see what you get comfortable with, what you like.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. She was doing... she's done more since then, but she was doing an etching which was done with a continuous fluid line,
oh, yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
she was working on.
Yeah, she followed through on that. She's got five prints going. They're big. They're like this.
Oh, beautiful.
About with a continuous line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other project that she was also working on was she was doing something melting. She was melting ink or something and using it in a sculptural way.
Yeah.
And she was standing in your artist's studio, looking at the prints, and she suddenly realized, I'm responding to Richard Serra, and they're next door in your shop, it's all Richard Serra's.
Yeah, yeah.
And the line drawings, I'm thinking about Ellsworth Kelly.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the history of the work that has been made in this place and trying to wrestle with it, which I think is it's going to be an interesting, kind of an interesting way forward with Gemini, these younger generation of artists thinking about this robust history.
Look, Anna Lee has probably been the most expressive about that subject. You know, not only is it Richard or Ellsworth, but I'm in the same place where they worked, you know, and so, she's responding and she's dedicating, really, at this point, I think.
I'm getting the signal, but I do want to click through
the signal.
We need to open it up for everybody else's questions. But I do want to just quickly look. There's a couple images here of Richard working, and I love this picture of you peering through the door.
Oh, doing what?
You're peering through the door of him and sees. Can you tell us what we're looking at?
Yeah, well, that's Richard Serra pouring a liquid, probably paint stick, onto surface, and then he would just dance and stomp on it, and there was probably loud music playing. He liked rock and roll music, and he was stomping on it to get texture, because what he really wants in his prints is, you know, an image with a lot of texture.
Mm-hmm. It's a messy process.
No. Richard, you get really very physical. Yeah, yeah. And Richard is, you know, he's a determined guy. And what I say is, you know, if he starts to work, get out of his way. He's like a locomotive. It just run you over. So, yeah.
I mean, the other thing that about this project is you can see how many printers he's working with. Which, you know, printers are the unsung heroes in this, right? They're essential to what happens at Gemini.
Yeah. It's a good subject. Well, it leads me into, this has been going on yesterday and today, and it's been going on for a long time, where Stanley and I get a lot of kudos or a lot of compliments for what we did as far as establishing Gemini. And, you know, I love to hear compliments, and it's great that it happens, but that story needs to be expanded, because, you know, Gemini is really about collaboration between the artist and the printers, and they're the ones that are making the prints, and that's a hard job. Mm-hmm. It's a hard, you know, I'll speak for the printer side of it. It's very demanding. You got to be intelligent, first of all, to be able to keep up with these artists, and you have to, you know, it's long hours, and it's very, very physical. You're an athlete if you're a printer. And so I think the printers need more recognition than they get, and they get it occasionally, but they're really the stars of the scene as far as what makes the prints. So,
that's great.
This has been the National Gallery of Art podcast.